Well, good morning, everyone. Okay. Welcome to session 9 of the ICSE conference, the joy of cultivating and soliciting major donors for your school. My name is Alex Prevetera. I am the Director of Development and Operations for the Catholic Community Foundation of the Diocese of Richmond. Very pleased to be the moderator for today's session. Before we go any further, we're going to start with the opening prayer for the ICSE conference. It's in your conference booklet, page 3. Conference prayer, we're going to pray this together. I'll give you a second to pull it out. Okay. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Loving and gracious God, we ask you to open our hearts to your Son's life and ministry, and to answer the call to be his disciples. May our response be rooted in the gospel. May we be ever mindful of the needs of our communities, and may our stewardship flow from a profound sense of gratitude for your many blessings. By the gift of the Holy Spirit, empower and inspire us to respond in a way that brings hope to others and reveals the love that comes to us through Christ, Jesus Christ. We ask this in his name, who is Lord forever and ever. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, sorry about that. It's my privilege to introduce Mary Foley, our featured speaker today for this session. Mary serves Christian Brothers in its Mission Advancement and Catholic School Management divisions. She has over 40-plus years of experience working in a not-for-profit world, has worked for hundreds of not-for-profits, and has raised hundreds of millions of dollars in various different ways of fundraising. So very pleased to have Mary here today. I will say that Mary thinks bios like this are very boring and tedious, so she's glad I'm not reading this all out word for word. So I just want you to be aware of that as well. With that, it's my privilege to introduce Mary Foley.
Good morning. Welcome, everybody. You know, they ask you for these bios, and you think, these poor people, they're going to session after session after session, and, you know, does anyone really listen? So here are the really important things. We're here. We're together. Beignets. What could be better than that? I am delighted to be here. I have been honored to be a speaker at this conference for many years because, you know, when Michael calls and says, Mary, will you do this topic on this day at this time? You just say yes. It's like, you know, how many of you went to Catholic schools? Okay, so, like, if a nun asked you to do something, what's the answer?
Yes, sister.
Yes, exactly. Well, Michael has now achieved that fame. You know, if Michael calls, you just want to say yes. I'm also really pleased to be here because over 25 years ago, I don't know exactly what year it was, but ICSE had a meeting. It was here in New Orleans, and for me, it was one of those life-changing experiences. For me, it was when the, you know, everything clicked about stewardship. And I'll never forget, at the end of the following year, they had this really great session on tithing. And at the end of the following year, I was talking to a good friend of mine, and she had attended that session as well. And I said, oh, I'm so excited. I just did my taxes, and I found out I was at 13% instead of 10%. And her immediate response is, and look at all the good things that have come into your life in the last year. And she was absolutely right. I, at a very late stage in time, you know, met the man of my dreams. And work was going really well, and it was just like, oh, you're right, tick, 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 tick. And I'm not saying it's a corollary so much as I have such fondness for ICSE, that session, and that it was in New Orleans. So I'm so pleased to be here, and thank you all for coming and taking the time out for this conference. I'm from Christian Brothers Services. Some of you may know us. We might provide health insurance for your employees, or you might be yourselves might be in our retirement plans. The slides are on HUBA. You can read all of this later. I work in two areas, mission advancement and Catholic school management. Again, you can read that later. But the one thing I did want to mention is that because Christian Brothers Services is a not-for-profit organization itself, we make a lot of our resources available for free. And I don't know about your schools. But I have yet to encounter a school that says, oh, no, we just have too many resources. We have all the staff we need. There's nothing that anyone else could provide us. We're good with money and people and everything. So please check out our website, our the webinars, newsletters. I think you would find them very, very useful. So the title of today's session, The Joy of Cultivating Soliciting Major Gifts, Major Donors for Your School, Michael came up with that, and I didn't really question it until I started thinking about the session, started preparing for it. Come on in. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, beware of the prepositional phrase, right? What if everyone thinks it's just about joy and not about sort of the nuts and bolts of cultivating and soliciting major donors? So fear not. That will not happen at this session. We are going to cover all of these things and with primary focus on the soliciting of your major donors. But this brings us to the obvious question. If we're going to be soliciting major donors, we need to know about why people give. So, why do people give? This is the part where we're having a lively exchange of ideas. Yes, sir.
I think one of the reasons people give is because they've experienced some personal benefit from the organization that they're giving to. In other words, they've got a personal connection to that organization. They want to support something good that happened in their lives for other people.
Excellent. Very true. What else? Why else do people give? Because they were asked. A very, very, very essential part. What else makes people give? Yes?
Contribute towards a goal, a need.
Right. There's an expressed need, a clear funding priority, and they want to help you achieve it. Yes, sir?
Gratitude.
Out of gratitude, yes. I'm actually doing another session later this afternoon, and we're talking a lot about gratitude in that. All these things are true. All of these things contribute to the decision to give. But the number one reason why people give is it makes them feel good about themselves. When people give to your school, they stand a little taller. They walk a little prouder. They know they've done something to improve your corner of the universe and their corner of the universe. That's their primary motivation. Now, if we ask the donors, of course, they're not going to say, well, it just makes me feel so good, Mary. But they, you know, that's what happens. And number two is exactly what you said, because they are asked. No matter how much benefit they got, no matter how much gratitude they feel, at some point somebody's got to do the asking. And that's all of you. But think of it this way. If people give because it makes them feel good about themselves, if you aren't out there asking, they're all just sitting around feeling bad. And we can't have that. That's not who we are. We're all about hospitality and welcoming. And so that's really the job here. It's all about you going out and helping people feel good about themselves by giving to your school. Thank you very much. I'm sure they will appreciate it. And if that's not enough motivation for you, take a look at this. Asking people for money is giving them the opportunity to put their resources at the disposal of the kingdom. To raise funds is to offer people the chance to invest what they have in the work of God. I think sometimes when we're at conferences and we're going from session to session, it's like fundraising and nuts and bolts and this and that and how can we raise more money and so on and so forth. But this is noble. This is to give people the opportunity to invest what they have in the work of God. What could be better than that? Now, I know possibly not everyone in this room is enormously excited. Like none of you woke up this morning and went, oh, that fundraising thing, I can't wait. Some of you may, in fact, prefer the thought of, you know, being dragged naked through cactus than asking someone for a major gift. But if you think about it this way, if you really put it in this context, it makes it so much easier to contemplate. So I hope that you will do that. And one thing I wanted to mention about Christian Brothers Services, So obviously we're connected to the Christian Brothers, the LaSallian Christian Brothers. And here is a great piece of Catholic trivia. You know, when you're playing Catholic Jeopardy, yesterday I was doing a board retreat for school in Philadelphia, and I flew in the night before and stayed in the mother house with the sisters. And so at dinner, they were like, you know, who was that? I'm from Chicago. Who was that cardinal, and what did he say, and what was it called? It was like, oh, my goodness, it's like Catholic Jeopardy. St. John Baptist de La Salle, the founder of the Christian Brothers, is the patron saint of teachers. And he's got a lot of really great quotes about teaching and, you know, the people who are entrusted to your care and things like that. So that could be a terrific resource for you when you're working with your schools. Okay, so we're making people feel good about themselves. We're enabling them to invest in the kingdom of God. If that doesn't say joy, I don't know what does. So there we go. We've taken care of joy, joy, joy. Now the second part of this title is about the school. And many of you went to Catholic school. What do you think the impact of that was on your lives?
Formative.
Formative.
Putting others first.
Putting others first.
Community.
Community, that feeling of family, beyond your family. I see a lot of nodding heads. So, have any of you seen the Simon Sinek talk, Start With Why? Okay, so if you haven't, I really encourage you. It's a TED talk, and it's only 17 minutes long, but one of the things that he talks about is how not-for-profit organizations tend to spend a lot of time, like in the picture, a really big circle, a lot of time talking about what we do, and a smaller amount of time talking about how we do it, and a really tiny amount of time talking about why we do it. But our why for Catholic education is the most powerful piece. You know, what do we do? Okay, well, you know, when it comes to academics, pretty much people have school figured out, math, English, science, history. But the why part of it is really, really important for us. If you were to, you know, because who doesn't want to read history of Catholic education in the United States, you know, it's like a then, but if you look at the impact of Catholic education on generations and generations and generations of Americans, it is amazing. It is incredible. Our country would not be where it is today were it not for the Catholic schools that have existed for these many years. The Catholic education is one of the most formative experiences a child could have. I believe it is one of the best gifts you can give your children. I think the children in our schools are fundamentally better off as a result of having been there. And I have always felt like this. I've always been rah-rah Catholic education. Now, I had the benefit. You know, when I was three, my parents bought a house so their kids could walk to Catholic grade school, high school, and college. All I wanted to do was get north of 99th Street once I finished college. Because back in the day, like, my daughter just started college. We made 11 college trips. Yeah, I made no college trips. It's like, why would we go? I would look at other schools. There's a great college right at the corner. I had the Sisters of Mercy for grade school, high school, and college. So, but it is probably the greatest force. Catholic education is probably the greatest force for the common good in the United States of America. That is, you know, I think undebated in this world. The other aspect of schools, are any of you parents of kids who went to Catholic schools? Yeah. So I married late in life. Finally, a daughter comes our way. Happiness, happiness, happiness. And let me just say, you know, when you're 45 and you have a baby, you know you're just going to be underperforming for the rest of your life. And my husband and I, we just knew this. And when she started school, we were so grateful. It's like, oh, thank goodness, finally we have a partner in this. So I don't know, maybe it was second grade. She's singing. She loves to sing, singing all around the house. And I realized she's singing a church song. You probably all know it. This is the day, this is the day that the Lord has made, that the Lord has made. Okay, but my daughter's not singing that. She's singing, this is the day, this is the day that the Lord has me, that the Lord has me. So I say, oh, honey, actually, it goes like this, that the Lord has made. And she looks at me, you know, like channeling her future adolescent self, like I'm out of my mind. And she goes, no, no, Mama, it's that the Lord has me. He has me. Thank God for Catholic school, because she did not get that from us. You know, let's just be, call a spade. So, you know, the power of our Catholic schools are just absolutely incredible. So I don't think anyone being put in a position of soliciting major gifts should ever feel daunted by that. You know, because while, yes, you're going after the funding priorities that are important for your school, you are also enabling people to invest in this glorious celebration of Catholic education in the United States of America. And let me just say, for those of you whose schools are serving a marginalized community, it is an even greater impact. You are not, you're not just leveling the playing field. You are enabling these kids and their families. There's research that shows that it's not just the child that benefits, but the entire family does. I work with a lot of schools where it's not only first gen going to college, it's first gen attending high school. You know, it changes everything. So thank you all for all the work you are already doing on behalf of Catholic education, because it really is a force to be reckoned with. Okay, so we've got joy, we've got schools. So major gifts. What does that mean to you? Like, everyone's major gift is going to be different. So what is it, what's it at your organization? What would you consider a major gift?
Probably
25,000. 25,000, okay. Who might have a somewhat more modest major gift? What's yours?
5,000.
What else? What's going on? 10,000.
No.
Okay. But you've made my point for me. Thank you, Owen. The point is that it doesn't matter if a major gift at your school right now is only $100, because it's something to shoot for. And the goal of a major gift program is that whatever you declare to be a major gift is continually rising. So that, you know, there are people who say, oh yeah, I started out as the first major gift officer at this school and a major gift was $250. You know, now the people I'm talking to are all 5- and 6-figure donors. You know, and that happens over time, which is why it's so important to have a plan for cultivating and soliciting your major donors, because we know if you take a look at the donor pyramid, you know, we know that 80% of our money tends to come from 20% of our people. And now some of you are very experienced fundraisers. You probably are finding that it's even thinner at the top, you know, like 90-10. But again, these numbers are national averages. What's important is, what does your donor pyramid look like? And let me just say, although it's off topic, I love annual fund. It's one of my favorite things in all the world. So let's not forget the people down here, because within school programs, we typically are soliciting alumni and alumni parents. So below the donor pyramid, the people aren't even on it, is usually a much bigger audience than the people who are on it. And again, if we aren't doing something to bring them into the pyramid, what's happening to these people? They're sitting around feeling bad about themselves. It's terrible. It's just a travesty. So we cannot have that. Okay, so let's get into this whole issue of major gifts. So, you know, it's just simple math. A lot of schools have annual fund programs, and they're good, but they kind of stay the same. Like, we do direct mail. We maybe follow it up with phone calls. We might have a parent pledge program, those sorts of things. But the more you can focus on building out a major gifts program, you know, it's just going to be easier. It's much easier to get 10 gifts of $1,000 each than 1,000 gifts of $10 each. So it's also a really great prelude to your annual fund. You know, typically what we see with major gift programs, even if it's just for annual dollars, not something special like a campaign, is that if you get that money first before you do your more general solicitations, now you've got a chance to be creative. You can set it up as a challenge gift. You can set create incentives for the people who will follow. I think that there's a real, you know, we all hear about Murphy's Law and, you know, bad things leading to worse things and all that. But I think one of the things we see in fundraising with our volunteers is the opposite of that. It's like the beneficent cycle. You know, none of your schools will probably have enough staff to ever reach out personally to as many donors as you would like. So you're going to need to use volunteers. But what do we know about volunteers? And they're giving. They give more. So the more they volunteer, the more likely they are to give and to give more generously. And then the more generously they give, the more likely they are to volunteer. And it's like, this is great. Let's keep it going. So, you know, in a nutshell, it's like, okay, we identify our prospects, we educate them, cultivate them, we solicit them, and then repeat. You know, there are basically only two ways to get better at anything in life, I believe. You either do more of it, you do it better, or you do both of those things. So with major gifts, that's always your goal. It's like if we're doing 100 major gift visits this year, we want to do 125 next year, 150, to always have it be growing. I talked to one school where they said their goal was to get everyone who was in any way affiliated with the school administration board, et cetera, to the point where they each had a portfolio of prospects. And there's this great school in Illinois, Bishop Mack in Kankakee. They started a phone-a-thon program in the 80s, the late 80s, calling their alumni. They have had volunteers calling the same people every single year. It's like, hey, it's that time again. I mean, it's an amazing thing to behold. And yes, people still call people on phones. I know we like to think that that's not the case. So repeat and expand. Okay, the cultivation piece of this, you know, I feel like people think cultivating prospective donors is a trick. Like, we're gonna invite you for cocktails and then we're gonna hit you up for money. This is not the case. You know, what we're really trying to do is to be constantly educating people, drawing them closer to the heart of the school, making them feel like they have a part in this magnificent endeavor that is Catholic education. And the next session I'm doing is about stewarding your donors, but of course we have to cultivate them before we get them to be donors. But if you're not already booked for 2:00, that's what I'll be, and I'm doing it somewhere, but I don't know where yet because I just got in at midnight last night. But you know, the other part of cultivation is just, you know, I just think it's good manners. I mean, what's one of the first things you say to your kid when they're little? One of the first instructions, please and thank you. Yes, say thank you. Write a thank you note. So let me just pause for a second. I see some of you taking pictures of the slides. The slides should be uploaded. Yeah. Oh, they are. Okay, good, because I'm always slightly doubtful about technology. Okay, I'm glad they're there. But it's just good manners. When I started working in development, it was 1982, I was the first full-time director of development at the Girls Catholic High School in Chicago. And I had a girlfriend who, I hadn't been working there all that long, and she was like, how is this a job? Which, let me just say, I took umbrage with. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, you know, tell people what's going on, ask for help when you need it, thank them when they do. You're right, I shouldn't have the step. And the day before yesterday, when I was going in the car from the airport to where I was doing this board retreat, the driver asked me what I did for a living, and I explained it. And he said, there was this pause at the end. And then he looked at me and went, is that fun? It's like, yes, it's the best job in the whole world. It's so great. You work with the wonderful people and all this. He did not believe me at all. And then when he said, I'm not familiar with this location. Am I taking you to private home? I said, no, to a convent. With nuns? I said, 70 of them. we have a very, very different world than the rest of the world, but aren't we lucky to have it? So cultivation is just good manners. So, but what are we educating them about? Well, you know, we want them to know our students' stories. We want them to know about the school. You know, especially if you're talking to alumni, the school they went to school at 50 years ago is not the same one as we have today. So we want to draw them closer, but overwhelmingly, I have found, and I'm sure many of you have too, is donors become more invested in your work. They themselves find their own faith life deepening. And that is another gift that you are giving them beyond the helping them feel good about themselves. The cultivation process enables you to identify opportunities. You know, yes, we need more money. We need to raise $175,000 a year to bridge the gap between tuition and actual expense. But, you know, everyone has their own hot button. You know, if you're talking to Mrs. Maloney, who graduated 75 years ago, and when I went to school, there were 50 kids in a class, and we ran around our desks for physical education, and we all got into the college of our choice. She is not going to be excited about your technology initiative. But you're expanding the library with places that will encourage young children to become readers. Well, what could be better than that? So it helps us identify the opportunities. And, you know, we hear this phrase a lot. You want to move donors from transactional giving to transformational giving. But I think, you know, what do we mean by that? We just want them to give more money, right? It's like a bigger gift rather than a token gift. But, you know, if it is really transformational for the school in the students' lives, it's going to be transformational for the donor as well. Henry Nouwen, isn't he great? You know, if you all haven't seen his book on the spirituality of giving or the spirituality of fundraising, I would encourage you to, they should be selling that at these conferences every year. It is. You should do something about that. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. Fundraising is not a response to a crisis. It is a form of ministry, a way of announcing our vision and inviting other people into our mission. Okay, so we have talked about the joy, the school, the major, and the cultivating. So now let's get on to soliciting. So in soliciting, we are, anytime you're asking for a gift on behalf of Holy Trinity Catholic School, and thank you so much for doing that, you have three objectives. You're sitting down, you're here with Robert, and you're asking him for a gift. You have three objectives. You want him to give, but you also want the experience of your time together to impel him toward future giving. And how many of your schools have bequest societies or have a concerted effort to get people to remember your school in their will? Tell us how you do yours. You know, one of the things, and we could have whole sessions on this, but bequest giving, I mean, there's one thing we know about every person, every potential donor you have right now, living today. What is it we know about those people? They're all going to die. And when we think about plant giving, bequest giving, you know, in death there's life. So we want to use, you know, if you're having a personal visit with a prospective donor, you want to introduce that idea. You're all interested in schools, so we know that you don't say, you know, 5 times 3 is 15 once and hope that everyone will remember it for the rest of their lives. They say it takes 8 to 18 reinforcements to begin to change a behavior or a mindset. So you want to build the relationship, and you want to find out, are there any issues that this prospective donor has that would get in the way of, if not this gift, future gifts? Now, I am a big believer in setting very, very clear goals. I think they are motivating. I think it is fun. I think it brings joy, which is handy because that's in the title of our program here. So, you know, every part of your development plan should have this. But this is the part I want to talk about, if we're thinking just about your major gift effort. You know, are we looking to acquire new donors at a certain level and above? How many? You know, often, how many of you have donor societies at your schools? You know, if you give $1,000, you belong to the Blue and Gold Circle. Oh, I would very much encourage you all to get donor societies at your school. It's a great way to help people move up to these levels. So acquiring people, then getting them to stay with you, and then, again, the whole upgrading and expansion model. The idea of campaign model is, you know, how many of you have done capital campaign work? Okay, you know how we have sort of, you know, we start with our small group of upper-level donors, and we're quiet about it in as much as anyone can be quiet these days with technology and, well, humans. But and then you broaden it. Well, you can use that same model for your annual fund, for a special project, et cetera. Okay. Oh, this is very exciting. So you're all out fundraising. What are you fundraising for? What do you need money for? To pay the teachers, okay? And you would like to pay them more, I am guessing?
Just pay what we're still... A fundraising amount and our revenue amount is not enough to
pay. Okay, so you've got a budget shortfall that you're trying to... Okay, what else are we raising money for?
Facilities?
How much money do you need? How much money does your school need, sir, for facilities? And what would you do with your $500,000?
A new library.
$500,000 library. Okay. What else are you raising money for?
Security upgrade.
A security upgrade. Excellent. And how much will that cost?
$30,000.
And what will that do? Okay, I think, so she said allow the doors to not be penetrated, also known as keep our little boys and girls safe. Yes. By the way, in elementary school, they're always little boys and girls. They're never teens. They're never adolescents. They're never young people. High school is you have to go with the young people. But when we're talking elementary, you want everyone to envision tiny praying children in plaid.
And the middle schoolers always look terrible on the marketing photos. The little kids you want to get.
Right, yes. Nobody even wants to be reminded, you know, the preteens exist. Okay, so if you're fundraising for a budgeting shortfall, if you need to bridge that gap, that is not exciting too many donors. And especially when we're doing it for schools, I always feel uncomfortable when we say, you know, we don't have a balanced budget. It's like, but you teach math. Surely you know how to balance a budget. So this is where your finance committee can be very, very helpful, or the school administration, like, let's sit down. Let's look at this budget. What, you know, oh, we've got this and this and this and this. It's already in the budget for next year. But when I pull those five things together, oh, there's our technology initiative, or here's our professional development program. And that can be of interest to donors. In fundraising, you know, one of the cardinal rules is always you'd ever want to ask a yes-no question. Why would you do that? They might say no. Never give them a choice. You want to have variety. So the question isn't, you know, would you like to give to our school? It's which of these appeals to you most? And then it's like Jeopardy. It's like select. So you want to have at any given time 3 to 5 funding priorities that have some range in them. So it's not all just technology. It's not all facilities. It's not all this. So that, you know, it gives the donor agency to be able to choose where their money is going to go. You need to be able to articulate all of it in a sound bite. People today have the attention span of gnats. So we really need them to be able to, you know, get it quickly. And one way to be able to get really good with your funding priorities is to say, okay, you know, how much is it going to cost? How many do we need? Oh, we need new windows for the science lab. Okay, how many windows? How much do they each cost? And then when we talk about features and benefits, so this young lady's feature is her security system, but the benefit is children's safety. And so it's the benefit that has the emotional appeal to it that really make people want to give. So if you always frame your fundraising priorities in terms of the features and the benefits, more emphasis on the benefits, that will serve you well. Now, how will these funds be used? Before you go out and ask people to give in support of funding priorities 1, 2, or 3, ask, you know, get some people together and say, okay, we're funding, you know, this is our funding priority. Ask me every question that could possibly come up. I want to be ready with answers. What possible objections could arise from here? So, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is when you're doing fundraising, let's say you're doing a phone-a-thon or something, you know, you've got your funding priorities and, you know, Mr. Zafra, I'm following up on the letter we sent you. You know, how do you feel about our efforts to improve academic excellence at our school? Yeah, you know, I've been doing this for 42 years. I've never heard anyone say, you know, I really think we've just done too much in that academic excellence. Like, I think we need to relax things a little bit. You know, all that grammar, all that science, really just not necessary. You know, you're always going to pose it in a way, you know, how do you feel about helping us keep children safe, improve the learning environment, and such and such. It's like, well, you'd have to be a unique individual, let me just say, to be opposed to that. Okay, so what's our process here? I'm going to talk about 2 different types of solicitation at the major gift level. One is personal solicitation, one-on-one, as I've sort of alluded to here. And then small group solicitation, which I like to call speed fundraising, because it's fast, it's efficient, it saves money, it saves time, and it can also be fun because, of course, you know, we're going to be the people who put the fun back in fundraising, right? Okay, so you identify who your prospects are. You figure out in prospect review what they're capable of doing. You design the solicitation strategy. You cultivate and appreciate them. And then you do it again and again and again. You have a plan for this calendar year, and it's just going to expand. So let's talk about this. Prospect identification. For those of you who already have fundraising programs set up, now is the time when you're running a lot of reports, no doubt, like your descending order report that shows everyone who's given so far this year and what they gave last year, so you can look for any gaps. It's like, oh, look, Mr. Jones gave us $10,000 last year, and he hasn't given it to us this year. Well, let's look into that further. He always makes his gift on December 1st. All right, I'm not worried about Mr. Jones. But Mrs. Kastenholz, who always makes her gifts on May 9th, she has not given. And she gave us $10,000 a year for the last 5 years. I am now worried about Mrs. Kastenholz. I want to find out what's going on. Is she unwell? Has she stopped liking us? So you run your descending order reports. You can see who have been most generous to us. And the live ones, those are the people who gave last year, but unfortunately not this year. You want to take a look at them because that's probably your first group. Between now and the end of the calendar year, which is only about 100 days, so tick, 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 you want to have a plan for those people. One of the things that I find with some schools is that we only look at the total. Like last year we raised $100,000, this year we raised $110,000, and everybody's happy. Except if you brought in a lot of new dollars this year and didn't notice that some people did not renew their gifts, what do we know about those people? They can be hard to get back if we ignore them. And they're all sitting around feeling badly about themselves. Yes, thank you very much. So this is really a moral obligation on your part to make sure that doesn't happen. So running these reports, I was with a school. I was doing a development audit for them, and they were up. They were up considerably over the previous year, and it sounded great. But they weren't up as much as I thought they should be, given that they had gotten a challenge gift. And so we ran the Libunt report, and they had $290,000 in lapsed donors, with over 100 of them at the 5,000, not 100 of them, 50 of them, I think, at the $5,000 level. I mean, it was extraordinary to me that someone could just get neglected like that because we were looking at the top. So all of these things have the potential to help you draw up who are we going to invite into our mission to invest in the kingdom of God more significantly on behalf of your school. So the first is we have to come up with the list of people that we are going to share this supreme opportunity with. Then we need to figure out what we are going to ask them for. We need to decide what kind of solicitation approach would be most effective for them. And, oh, sorry about that. Oh, dear.
Did it run out of batteries?
Oh, no, there we go. Okay. So basically, you want to get as much information as you can about them in all these areas in order to design something that will be both comfortable and effective. So comfortable for you, the solicitor, comfortable for you, the donor, and ultimately successful in terms of securing a major gift. So some of the things that you'd like to be looking at is, you know, what kind of relationships do they have? Who is the best person to ask someone for a gift? A peer, someone who is already given, that knows them, that has a relationship with them. Excellent. Who else? The principal of the school, the top leader. Both of these are correct answers. One of the questions you want to ask is, you know, to whom can they not say no? And in a school, that answer can be fascinating. You know, it's like, oh, we're going to be asking the Smiths for a $10,000 gift. But they had Mrs. LaCour in, you know, fifth grade, and they're always talking about how wonderful she is. Huh. Wouldn't it be fun for you to come with us on this visit? Especially since, you know, one of our funding priorities is new classroom furniture that impacts learning for students with special needs. And they have a special needs child. So you tell all those things. So thank you for coming. We make it so much fun. So who do they have relationships with? What do we know about them? This, who's the decision maker? Our pastor called my husband recently, who is retired, and said, we're starting this new 501c3. We need someone to help with finance. That's the field he worked in. Well, you know, basically they wanted someone to help with bookkeeping. But nonetheless, he says yes, because it's your pastor, and that is what you do. So there's a meeting, and unbeknownst to him, I might have possibly talk to a board member of this newly created entity and said, if you wanted to have a small group solicitation, I would host it at our house. I don't feel the need to burden him with all the information in the world. So, he goes to the first meeting and they say, oh, thanks so much. We're so grateful to you for hosting this party. And he says, what party? And, you know, the one where we're fundraise, you know, he goes, where? It's like, at your house. And then they later go on to say, you know, we've gotten our first gift. It's for $10,000. She's like, was it from me? I don't know. How would I know these things? So knowing who the decision maker is very important. One of the great things about schools is that you can get matching gifts. Matching gift employers will see you as education versus religion. There was one school I worked with, they had a couple come in, they were doing like a refreshing campaign and of the facilities, and they wanted to do the, and you know how it is when you're making up the named gifts, you're looking for anything you could possibly name. So they came in, it was kind of late in the campaign, and so they, there wasn't a whole lot left on my list. And I was like, well, you know, you were thinking about $15,000, and you know, this is what you can name, and you know, and they go, oh, look, it's the fire suppression system. I did not think that would be a big deal, but he was a fireman, and they loved the idea that they were helping keep the kids safe. And then at the end, they were like, yeah, I don't think they'll do it for this because it's a Catholic school, but, you know, he works for XYZ Corporation, and they match. And I said, well, I'd be happy to call them up and find out. They match 3-1. Yeah, so employment, very important thing to know about. How they're involved, their capacity, you know, what do we know about them that will enable us to propose an amount that's appropriate. And if I were to say 60% is a number you really should embrace, does anyone know what I'd be talking about? So most people give 60% of what they are asked. So you have to make sure that when you're setting your ask amounts, you take that into consideration. Let's say, in support of the school security system, what's your name?
Elizabeth
goes out, and it's $30,000, you said? So she's targeted 10 people. She's going to ask them all for $5,000 because they're not all going to say yes. And she keeps getting $3,000 gifts. What does this tell us?
More.
You need to ask for more. Now, let's say she goes out and the first six people she talks to all give her $5,000. You didn't ask for enough. You're absolutely right, sir. So, you know, and we don't want them to feel less good about giving. Or we want to get them to get maximum insight. So a way, you know, for those of you who have worked in capital campaigns, you're familiar with the whole put together an anonymous committee of people who can provide insight in these areas. There's no reason you can't do that for your major gift effort and do it on an annual basis. The key is that the people on the committee have to have the right stuff, which means that they not only have knowledge that would be useful to you to make sure that this is an effective approach, a respectful approach, but they also can't be people who are going to take that information anywhere else. When we facilitate prospect review, we go over the sacred trust nature of it again and again. And I've had people say, you know, after I get through my little diatribe on it, it's like, you know what? I can't do it. You know what, if I learn something, I'm going, you know, it won't be malicious. It'll just come up in conversation. I know who I am. And, you know, people joke, don't, you know. Now, sometimes those people have a lot of information, those people who talk and talk and talk and talk, but you don't want to risk it. 10 minutes, okay. So this is what you're trying to accomplish in the solicitation strategy. So what are we asking for? What would be the most effective approach? Is it one-on-one? Would it be in a small group thing? Who should do the soliciting? should they take someone with, like the fabulous teacher that we've met earlier today? What are they interested in? What are their issues and concerns, et cetera? So that's kind of the personal solicitation process. Some of the things that you will find to be helpful, we mentioned challenge gifts and donor societies. Also, if you're doing this with a lot of people, I find that it's really helpful if you bring them all together before it gets started. Because here's what happens. You have a training program. They come in. They learn how to do this. They're committed. Here's your list of prospects. You know, please call them within a week because we've sent these pre-approach letters. Yes, yes, Mary, yes.
Yes, 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 yes. And then a week goes by, and you check in. How's it going? How many appointments do you have? It's like, I'm going to get to that right away.
If you bring them all into the school, make it a bring-your-own-cell-phone party, the likelihood of getting it started, much, much more effective. Recognize that there will be people for whom this is not their calling. We all have our gifts. I was doing one campaign at a parish, and at the appointment-setting phone-a-thon, at the end of it, this couple came and said, ours all said no. Can we get 10 more names? Like, not on your life. You know, I have a much more important project for you that I could really use your help with. Okay. So there are this, you know, kind of walks you through the solicitation steps. We could have a whole session on going through each of these steps, but since they have vetoed my idea that, you know, our session lasts 4 hours, they said no. but if anyone is interested, I have slides related to each of these steps, but if anyone is interested in getting them, I have a sign-up sheet here. Just make a note, and we'd be happy to email them to you. Okay, speed fundraising. And I am going to speed through this. But, you know, so now we know all of the process that goes into figuring out who you're going to help feel good about themselves by investing their resources in the kingdom. The beauty of small group solicitation is that you bring a group of people together and you ask them to give. So it's very, very efficient. Now, it can't be as personalized as one-on-one. So one-on-one is always at the top. But if there's no way we can get to all the people we want to get to, then we absolutely want to move next to small group fundraising. And you can do this in a couple different ways. One way is everyone in the room has the same ask amount. And that's beneficial because now, oh, look at this. Everyone here is being asked to join the donor society at $5,000 each. And, oh, so he's going to give, she's going to give, she's... Oh, well, phone's giving. I've totally got to do this. So that is one way to do it. Now, you might have someone who says, I will host one of these speed fundraising things, but I'm a member of the choir, and I just want to invite all the people in the choir to this event. So I'll be food and facilities, you know, someone else can talk about this. Well, in that case, they're all going to have different ask amounts because we've all been blessed differently when it comes to finances. So that is less effective because you can't announce a specific amount for everyone. When you do it that way, they leave with a package that has their unique ask amount in it. And then you have to follow up. So, you know, you can do it by ask. You can do it like the organizational piece. You know, you might have someone who says, hey, I am happy to have this party. I'll have it at my club. It'll be very cool. I will pay for everything, but I get control of the guest list. Thank you very much. Or in some cases, usually we do this with a capital campaign when you're really trying to speed things along and get it done. We might have five different parties that they can choose from, and we'll list all of them. So then it's like, this is what's most convenient for me. This is what is, this is, oh, I really want to see his house. So, they can do that. Connecting it to a donor society can be highly effective. I put a couple slides in here. I won't go through each of them, but basically it's sort of like the outline of who says what and how and so on and so forth. And I want to say, if anyone is feeling like this, because I have, you know, when I've done workshops, things, this has been a question. It's like, really? People come to this? And they absolutely do. Because anyone who's on the list as a major gift prospect probably already loves your school. And so, and this is a new and different and engaging way to invite them to invest. So I think we've covered all of this. The one thing I do want to say is you have to have a good answer for this. Why are you worthy? There are a million different charities they can support. So why your school? Why specifically your children? Because all those benefits we talked about all go back to the children. And look at this. The joy of giving. I didn't make this up. Hank said this. I don't know who Hank is, but you know, I'll give him a thumbs up on this. Okay, I'm going to, these are some tricks of the trade. I just want to mention this. So, you're having people over. You know Joe Smith's going to give. You have a little chat with him ahead of time. And spontaneously at the event, when you say, any questions? Guess what happens with Joe? Can we just give now? Why, yes. Vi has the credit card machine right here. By a coincidence. So having a donor plant can be very, very helpful. Afterwards, this is the follow-up process. And you can read that at your leisure. And then I included a couple slides about donor societies. You know, you give this much, here's the benefit. One of the things that we have, who remembers who this is? Yeah, what counts? You know, this will be a big debate. What counts? Does this count? Well, that didn't count for this, it counted for that. It's like, really? I would let it count for every, you know, count everything. And Sister Mary Tracy, who some of you may know, had this great quote, whenever two or three are gathered in a gift club, it's time to start a new one. So you're always building out more. Okay. This has been a lot of talking from me. Yes.
So much great content. Thank you.
Thank you.
Two questions for the recording.
It seems that we could all use some more information on donor societies. Do you have any examples you could direct us to of what other schools do for their donor societies so we can get an idea of levels and benefits to assign to each of those levels if we're going to start a donor society from scratch for our school? And then question number two, capacity study. How do we determine an appropriate ask amount besides assuming someone is well off or not based on their occupation?
The first question is, yes, I have a fair amount of resources on donor societies. I mean, the easiest thing is just look at schools that are bigger and have more mature development programs, and you'll probably find it right on their websites. But if you would like some slides I have from other presentations, just sign up and mark that down, and we will send you what you need. So if, you know, you're just getting started with that, start with your descending order report, because if they have a giving history, that will tell you something. And look at their past giving. And how many of you are at schools that are associated with a parish? Okay, if you can get their parish giving as well, that's really helpful, because one of the things that we know, that people will tend to be not as generous as perhaps they could be with their parish on in an ongoing basis. But if you can also look at like what your annual diocesan appeal is, it's like, wow, this guy's only giving $2,000 a year to the parish, but he's giving $10,000 each year to the annual appeal. That tells you something about capacity. The other thing that you can do, you know, now because of the wonderful world of technology, is that, you know, lots and lots of organizations post their donor lists, their annual reports, on their websites. So if you can, you know, if in your community, you know, the YMCA is a big thing, the, you know, some other civic things, you can get a lot of that information. And often when you just start pulling people together and, you know, add, oh, the other thing I can send, if you're interested, is
for prospect review, sort of a script for doing that. You know, questions to ask the people in the committee that would stimulate their thinking about ideas. Like, oh yeah, I know he belongs to such and such a country club. Well, that country club, you know, you can find out what does it cost to be a member and what is the monthly get and things like that. So it all contributes to a donor profile.
Okay.
Other questions?
We're at the 9:30 mark. Any other questions at all?
I'm going to Starbucks after this, so if you have other questions, please feel free to meet me there.
Big thank you to Mary Foley. Great job, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for everything you do.
Please make sure to fill out the session evaluation on your Whova app. We would really appreciate that. And have a great rest of the conference. Thank you.